It was only a barn surrounded by a few acres, and nothing like what we were used to. But it would allow us to keep 10 to 15 horses in training. We cleaned it out thoroughly with a hose. We hammered up partitions, mended gates, and scrubbed concrete floors until they glistened. We walked over the ground inch by inch to clear any nails and the remnants of fencing wire that might damage the horses' feet. We connected the water supply, set gates back on their hinges, contrived a bin for the feed. The smell of horses was in my nostrils again, and that meant happiness. Although my father was a frightening man, he had given me back what I wanted most in the world, a future with horses. More specifically, my future lay with the brown gelding called Brownie, who was one of the first arrivals at the Villa Street facility. Brownie was 15 hands, his mother a Mustang mare and his sire a thoroughbred, one of the government remount stallions. This was a project whereby the U.S. Cavalry took thoroughbred stallions and set them loose to run with the Mustangs on the open range. The ranchers got a payment if they shot a Mustang stallion. The thoroughbred stallions could thus take over the females and breed a class of horse suitable for the military. The cavalry had first call to come back and capture the young males for themselves, while the ranchers could keep the fillies as further payment for their cooperation. As his name implied, Brownie was a medium brown all over, except for about 8 inches of a softer doe-skin color on his muzzle and a small white dot between his eyes, which gave him a concentrated, pointed look. He had well-shaped feet with flint-hard hooves, a legacy of his Mustang heritage. Domestic horses raised on soft ground need regular visits from the farrier to keep their feet healthy. But owing to the minerals Mustangs eat and the constant teasing of the feet from running over rocks, Mustang hooves are so strong a nail could hardly penetrate them. The minute Brownie arrived and I knew he was to be mine, I wanted to bond with him closely. "Okay," said my father, "let's break him." My heart sank. How could I be this animal's best friend when his tentative trust in human beings was about to be abused? But I was too frightened of my father to stop it. As Brownie waited in his stall, my father rooted among some old slatted boxes used for the commercial transport of vegetables. He found what he was looking for, a cut of heavy crepe-like paper used to line the crate. He twisted one end and tied it to the end of a rope. Brownie was tied to a single post that had been driven deep into the ground. He stood patiently while my father walked around behind him, coiling the rope with the paper tied to the end of it. My father lobbed the paper, and Brownie jumped sideways as if his life depended on it, which to his way of thinking it did. His head snapped around, brought up short by the rope. This was just the beginning. As I watched Brownie's eyes widen and roll in fear, I felt dread and sympathy in equal doses. I cursed inwardly and wanted more than anything to untie the rope. I tried in vain to think how I might make it up to him. Years later, while Brownie and I were trekking over the high desert for days at a time, I felt compelled to offer him an apology for the vicious sacking out and the paper terror he would feel until the day he died. I talked to him, tried to put things right, and hoped he understood. Brownie never forgot the sacking out. All his life he was phobic about paper. Anything that sounded remotely like paper would send him into a panic, and he would be dangerous to himself and to others. He would bolt, and no one could tell him that it was only paper, nothing to fear. Never angry with Brownie for this blind spot in his nature, I accepted it as our fault, our crime against him. When my father became a policeman, our car became a police car. The ward made vehicles of any description difficult to come by. When he joined up, my father was told he would earn a higher salary if he offered to equip his family car for police work. Consequently, many policemen's private cars were fitted with red emergency lights, sirens, and radios. Special spotlights and lighting systems were installed to adapt the car for driving in blackout conditions. The West Coast was vulnerable to enemy attack, and blackouts were common. I recall my father coming home one day. We were then still living at the competition grounds. and saying we needed a larger vehicle to pick up writing students. The Mullers, who owned a mortuary in Salinas, had just the car for us, the limousine used by the immediate family in the funeral procession. The huge 1932 Cadillac sedan, with enormous running boards, was like a car from a gangster movie. Fitted with every option under the sun, it had acres of space inside and would accommodate many more riding students than any new car we might have bought for the same price. As with many automobiles of its day, the trunk consisted of a large metal box, like a footlocker, which bolted onto the back of the car. Now the black Cadillac was a patrol car for my father. I sometimes accompanied him to his training sessions. My father could handle every man there and most instructors with a smile on his face. He was fearless. There was never a cell of fear in that man. I can remember riding with my father when he got calls over the radio, or when he saw someone violating the traffic code. The red light would come on, the siren would sound, and he would race off to apprehend the suspect. He carried his badge with him always and kept a citation pad and handcuffs in the glove compartment. There was also usually a handgun. Late in the evening of one spring day in 1943, we were driving home from caring for some pasture horses. It had been a long day of riding and attending to their keep. Now it was getting dark. Near the city limits, a call came over the radio concerning an armed robbery in progress at the Golden Dragon Saloon on Soledad Street in Chinatown. My father picked up the hand microphone and responded, "I'm just a block and a half from the Golden Dragon, and I'll answer that call." The radio dispatcher asked, "Are you armed?" My father replied, "Yes." A bolt of fear ran through me. In all the times I had been with him when he answered police calls, he had never had to defend himself with a gun. He flipped the switches for the siren and the flashing light. The car veered wildly from side to side as it covered the distance. The headlights picked up people leaping out of our way. He barked at me, "Get down on the floor." The tone of his voice conveyed the seriousness of the situation. I quickly slid from the seat and into the footwell underneath the dash and waited. My heart was beating loud and fast, and I could almost smell my own fear. What happened next changed me forever. I would push the incident I'm about to describe into a dark corner of my mind, until one day, returning from a horse sale on a mostly empty airplane, I took out a tape recorder and the truth poured out of me, fresh blood from an old wound. There are days when I regret disinterring these memories. The whole picture remains crystal clear, as if it had happened yesterday. Some members of my family advised me that this incident should have no place in the book, and I weighed their counsel carefully before making the decision to reveal it, probably the single most important influence in my life. But what I saw on that day had a profound impact on the way I deal with horses, though not a single horse featured in the events of that night. Before then, I was a different person. In a way, I was born that evening, at the age of 8. My father, you should know, had been brought up in the tough, sometimes cruel world of the American pioneer. So much changed during those early decades of the 20th century that the single generation between my father and me felt like a great chasm. During his childhood, he would have faced almost daily the natural law of kill or be killed. In later years, he mellowed. When my wife Pat came to know him, he was no longer the cold, rigid man I had known as a child. The fight had drained from him. My children remember him as a fine grandfather. I'm also at pains to point out the difficulty my father had with the issue of race. Half Cherokee, he had suffered racial abuse in his youth, and he felt a deep shame about his Cherokee mother. Ironically, a little Cherokee blood ran in his own wife's veins. Yet he was angry that the Second World War had brought black people to our otherwise white community. Fort Ord was a 20-minute drive away, and many black servicemen were stationed there. Given the chance, victims of racial prejudice are sometimes the first to inflict it on others. This isn't to excuse what happened, and neither am I trying to vilify my father. But for as long as I live, I'll go on trying to understand what he did that night and how it shaped me. As the car sped toward the crime scene, my father issued a second order. Get me the gun and the handcuffs. I flipped the latch on the glove compartment and quickly removed the handcuffs, but I couldn't feel the gun. Frantically, my fingers swept through the maps, pens, and other detritus, but in vain. He was cursing at me to hurry. Damn, he said. I was sure I brought it with me. He had already grabbed the handcuffs and shoved them into his pocket. The Cadillac slid to a halt a few doors down from the Golden Dragon. He leapt from the car almost before it stopped moving, shouting to me just before he slammed the door, "Stay in the car, on the floor!" I lay there, curled under the dash, as the flashing neon lights of the saloon's facade filled the car with an eerie, pulsating glow. It was cramped where I lay, with its smell of barn dirt, sweat, and damp wool from the carpet. I wrestled with the urge to sit up, partly to escape the smell, but mainly to see what was happening. As I crept up to the seat, my eyes were now level with the bottom of the driver's window. I had a direct view of the bar entrance some 20 yards away. The street was lined with people, some talking to my father and pointing to the saloon. They were agitated, whispering among themselves as my father went inside. Though stiff with panic, I reached over to the door handle and eased it open. Everyone was focused on what was going on just inside the saloon doorway, so no one saw me crawling along. I crabbed sideways to gain a spot near the door. It seemed like everything had gone silent, because all I could hear was the thumping of my heart as I peered into the bar. Inside, no more than 5 feet away, I saw my father with his back to me. The bar's patrons were scattered to the farthest corners of the room. A tall, heavy-set black man in army fatigues was the only person moving. I seldom encountered blacks in Salinas. He wasn't a man to me, but a black man. He swerved to point a knife that looked the size of a sword, maybe it was a bayonet, in the direction of the bartender and shouted, "Put the money on the bar!" The frightened bartender pulled bills from the register, scattering coins to the floor in his haste. The robber, who may have been 20 years old, had spread his coat on the bar and collected a small heap of watches, rings, bracelets, and wallets. Evidently, he had been cleaning out the patrons. The plan was to use the coat as a sack and then make his escape. At this point, my father lifted his badge high in the air so everyone could see his authority, and he shouted, "Police! Stand where you are! Put down the knife and place your hands on the bar!" All time stopped now. The black man turned to face my father, his knife pointing directly in front of him. My father was a big man, but the man at the bar was huge. I silently begged my father to give way. He didn't. He stepped forward, walking toward the knife. Serious injury or even death awaited him. It was a brave act. Terror overtook me. In those few seconds, I saw myself fatherless. "Don't do this to yourself," my father said as he kept walking forward. "Put the knife on the bar, turn around, and put your hands in the air. Give it up." When they were inches from each other, and just when I thought the man would give way after all, he struck. He made a quick thrust with his knife hand, aiming for my father's ribs. My father's hand snaked out and grabbed the man's fist exactly where it closed on the knife handle. With a quick folding action, he locked the robber's elbow backward and set the knife spinning to the floor. The pressure on his twisted arm caused the man to fall back, and his head cracked on the edge of the bar. He continued his free fall to the floor and hit his head again, this time on the brass footrail. He lay motionless in a heap. It was over. I experienced a rush of emotion. My father was alive, and though unarmed, had brought down a knife-wielding thief. He was a hero. But it wasn't over. At this point, my father, a powerfully built man who weighed about 220 pounds, put the cuffs on the man and stood over him. He raised one foot and locked his heel behind his thigh, elevated his body, and then dropped, driving his knee into the chest of the unconscious black man. I was shocked, but my father's next move was even more appalling. He lifted one foot, took aim, and with all the force he could muster, slammed the heel of his cowboy boot into the mouth of the fallen man. He then picked up the knife and handed it to the bartender, asking him to carry it for him. Turning to his prisoner, he grabbed the chain connecting the handcuffs and hauled on it, dragging the black man, who was limp as a sack of feed, his hands high over his head. As my father turned toward the doorway, it struck me, almost too late, that I wasn't where I was supposed to be. I turned and ran. As I slid into the driver's seat and closed the door behind me, I saw my father emerge from the bar, surrounded by onlookers. He gave the torso an extra lift and then released the chain, dropping the back of the man's head onto the sidewalk. When my father arrived at the car, dragging his prisoner behind him, he went around and opened the passenger side of the car, taking the knife from the barman and placing it carefully on the seat beside me. Then he went to the rear of the Cadillac and opened that big trunk-like box. He took empty grain sacks and laid them over the rear floor space so the black man's blood wouldn't stain the interior. He opened the doors wide, heaved the man inside, then got in the car himself. The knife was an object of fear for me, but I was torn between sitting close to the knife or sitting close to my father. My father instructed me to pick it up by the blade and place it in the glove compartment. A measure of the size of a 1932 Cadillac's glove compartment is that this long knife fit inside. As we drove off, I could hear sounds coming from the man's throat, but my father said he was faking his injuries. "He'll be just fine." By now, other patrol cars had joined us on our way to the police station. Their sirens joined ours in a wailing that precisely caught my own inner mood of anguish and despair. My father used the car radio to tell his colleagues how the thief had attempted to cut him with a knife. The tale was told with bravado. Turning around, I looked down to see if the man was still breathing. I could only see bubbles of blood around his mouth. I pleaded with my father to take him to the hospital, not the police station. He simply repeated that the man was faking his injuries. On arrival at the station, my father opened the car door and dragged the man onto the sidewalk. For good measure, as if testing for resistance, he again drew the black man's shoulders up a few feet and dropped him with a crack onto the cement. Other officers, emerging from the station of their patrol cars, laughed and hooted at this display. My father picked up the chain again and hauled, so the unconscious prisoner's hands were once more over his head, as if in surrender. Lifting the man's head and torso off the sidewalk, he used the handcuff chain to drag the man backward up the concrete steps fronting the police station. "Get the knife out of the glove box," he barked to one of the officers. "Don't touch the handle." He would take a few steps, hoist his prisoner, take a few more steps, and repeat the process. The man was being conveyed into jail like an awkward piece of furniture. No one made any attempt to find a stretcher or to help my father. This was his trophy. He had bagged it, and now he was bringing it home to display it before his brother officers. They hollered and laughed behind him, sidestepping the trail of blood. Inside the station, at the top of the stairs, was the sergeant's desk. Dragging the black man the last few feet to a point opposite the desk, my father dropped him on the concrete floor. "I've pulled an ID from his pocket," he said. "Here's his name. Book him and send someone to get his prints." By this time in his police career, my father was a sergeant talking to a fellow sergeant. His imperious manner was that of a hunter after a kill. The sergeant fed a sheet of paper into the typewriter, and the keys began their staccato beat. Officers lit cigarettes and gathered to hear my father's tale. There was a second telling, this time with more violence and drama. The man lay unconscious on the floor, and I feared he was dying. I pulled at my father's coat to beg him to do something. My father looked down and shouted, "You get back in the car and shut up. The man is just faking it. There's nothing at all wrong with him." At this point, the man seemed to regain consciousness and struggled to stand. Still handcuffed, he staggered forward toward the shaft of light coming through the door. No one made a move to stop him. "Get in the car, Monty," said my father, who almost casually turned to follow his prisoner. The man didn't go very far. He stumbled at the top of the steps and dove headlong, striking his head against a tree. Again he lay motionless. By now I was crying uncontrollably. My father again yelled, "Get in the car!" as he approached the prisoner. Through the window I saw my father kick him repeatedly in the ribs with the toe of his cowboy boot. This last display seemed for the benefit of four or five officers standing at the entrance. Finally, he dragged the prisoner up the steps and deposited him through the door. Back in the Cadillac, I buried my face in the upholstery, sobbing. Soon I heard the sound of the car door opening and slamming shut, then the scrape of the key in the ignition. We were going home. 4 days later, I summoned enough courage to ask my father what had happened to the man he had arrested in the saloon. He replied, "Oh, he died." He must have felt my shock, because he quickly said, "He didn't die of his injuries. He died of pneumonia. That boy refused to pull the blankets over him at night, and he caught pneumonia and died." I believed the story, and I believed him. From then on, throughout my boyhood, I was careful at night to pull the covers up to my chin. Years later, I was told that the black man had lain for 2 days with his ribs broken, his lung pierced, and his skull cracked. He died without ever seeing a doctor. Later, in psychology courses, I'd learned how kidnappers and child molesters kill small animals in front of their victims to instill in them such fear that they are unable to fight back. My father's brutalizing of the young soldier wasn't aimed at me at all. He tried, in fact, to hide it from me. But the effect on me was the same as if he had forced me to watch. I understand now that I became a victim of my father's aggression. Then I only knew how much I feared him. But from that point forward, I knew I had to direct my life away from him. There's a postscript to this incident. 2 months later, my father asked me to come with him one evening. "We're going to the fights," he said, "and you're going to meet a very special man there." We drove to the National Guard Armory, passing crowds of people as we pulled up outside. We entered a room at the back of the exhibition hall where a large black man was seated on a table. My pulse shot up. He was the first of his race I had seen since the robbery. My father drew me closer and said, "Come on, Monty. Meet Joe Lewis. He's the heavyweight champion of the world." Joe Lewis greeted my father by name. My father had been hired as one of the bodyguards to protect the champion. "Hi," said my father. "Meet my son, Monty." I refused to go closer. "Come on," said the boxer. "I won't hurt you." I shook the hand of Joe Lewis, but I couldn't look him in the eye. Hoping to get past my shyness, he pointed at his shoulder and said, "Hey, little man, hit me. I dare you." It was a game I couldn't play. In the end, he took my hand, folded it into a fist, and tapped it against his shoulder, feigning injury. "Now," he said, "you can say you knocked out the world champ." A photographer setting up nearby signaled his readiness. My father lined up beside Joe Lewis, and the flash popped. I still have the photo of Lewis, an imposing man, flanked by 4 uniformed, hatted men at least his size or bigger. It's hard to read Lewis's look, but the others, all white, seem more pleased to be in his company than he is in theirs. On the way home, my father was remembering how Joe Lewis, a celebrity bystander that night, had signed autographs while sitting in one corner of the ring. He'd signed hurriedly, then dropped the paper onto the floor of the ring so the autograph seekers had to pick them up.
"The nigger in him had to come out, didn't it?" railed my father.
A woman named Nola Hightower worked for us in our house, and though my father treated her well, behind her back she, too, was a nigger. Later, when I played high school football, his advice to me was to hit the black players hard early in the game and they'd not bother me again, because niggers lack courage. My father was a racist, and the black and white photograph of him smiling with his arm around Joe Lewis is, for me, a powerful memento. When I was 8, I started riding quarter horses in sprint races, and my education in horsemanship moved up another notch. Quarter horses were and are stout, easy keepers with well-developed feet and calm dispositions. Typically small, the quarter horse possessed a conformation one might call the muscular bulldog type, with exceptionally well-rounded hindquarters and a deep chest, a deep heart, as horsemen say. The breed was originally known in the 1930s as Copper Bottom, and later as Steel Dust, after the two principal sires who launched this specialist breed. Easily trained, they were bred for ranch work because their terrific acceleration made them ideal for roping cattle and cutting a cow out of a herd. During the week, they would work on the ranch, and during weekend rodeos, they would be entered in the roping events and steer wrestling competition. After a few minutes' rest, the quarter horses would swap their heavy western rigs for the jockey's postage stamp saddle, and they'd be raced on the bush tracks that surrounded the rodeo arenas. In shorter races, no horse could beat them. They were the equine equivalent of drag racers. In fact, many of these horses never drew a breath until after they crossed the finish line. Only as they slowed did they realize the need for a change of air in their lungs. Because of the distance involved, a quarter of a mile, the breed became known as the quarter horse. This new type of competitive event was called sprint horse racing. I loved the excitement of it. To minimize weight on the back of the animal, the smallest boys were picked as riders. My fee, which the owner paid, was $5 to ride and $10 to win. Little towns up and down California, Salinas, King City, Fresno, Victorville, Stockton, held these short horse or quarter horse meets. The gambling was unregulated and unsanctioned. Like any backroom gambling, it made for a charged atmosphere. Riders were also unlicensed, nor was much concern shown for their safety. I had no serious accidents, despite riding in some 200 sprint races, mostly quarter horse races, until I was 13 years old, although I did fall off a time or two, and I often rode in races without a protective helmet. In 1949, no longer able to keep my weight down below the 130-pound mark, I rode my last race in King City. It was just a ranching town, but for quarter horse racing, two owners there had become important, Guile Norris and the McKenzie brothers. The latter owned a top-class mare named Lady Lee, whom I was lucky enough to ride a few times. They also owned Dee Dee, who was 1946 champion, older male of the quarter horse breed. One of my fellow racers in those days was the aptly named Tucker Slender, a tall, thin fella, 3 or 4 years my senior and a much better jockey than me. He went on to become the head starter at many of the major tracks in Southern California, and at Santa Anita and Del Mar, he's still the head starter. Slender knew, and I would learn, that horses and starting gates don't always mix. One day I was at Frank Vessel's track, then still quite rustic, as his trainer, a man named Farrell Jones, coped with a young quarter horse. The horse wheeled about behind the starting gate, eyeing its doors as he might the jaws of a crocodile. The track spooked him. The blocks of hay where we sat spooked him. The sky itself rattled him. Accompanying this young horse was an older stablemate who knew the ropes. "Right then," said Farrell calmly. "Let's load him into the gates." Farrell was a ruddy fireplug who lost his hair early. In training quarter horses to bolt from the starting gate, it was then common practice to shut the novice horse inside and put the whip on him. The thinking was to drive the horse into a frenzy so he'd be anxious to escape once the gate flipped open. And every subsequent time in a starting gate, he'd remember the fear, and the instinct to run would guarantee a better performance. Occasionally, electric shocks were applied to achieve the same effect. I watched as Farrell Jones now took the nervous horse and walked him through the starting gate. Then he went around again, and again. This continued until the few of us watching began to get dizzy. The horse himself must have been on the edge of being bored with these endless circles. Finally, he let him in and shut the front gate, offering a mouthful of feed in a bucket to make him feel at home. His stablemate was nearby, easily visible through the slatted sides. And there they stood. I was confused. Was the training session designed to make the novice horse learn effective starts in a race? Or was this, in fact, his new stable? However, once the horse had grown comfortable behind the closed gates, they were opened. But he was not let out. No, he was allowed to take his time and to decide for himself whether he wanted to leave, if ever. When he did so, it seemed to me like an exciting moment. Farrell Jones was eliminating every ounce of pressure from the training procedure. I also began to see another reason for having the stablemate on hand. With the gates closed and the novice horse inside, the stablemate was walked down the track a ways. The gate was opened, and without any encouragement, the novice stepped daintily out of the stall and strolled up the track to join his friend. A while later, the older pace horse was set going at a faster walk and allowed to get farther down the track. Now the novice had to shrug into a gentle trot to catch up with her. Not many hours later, Farrell Jones had his novice horse entering the stalls without the slightest fuss, waiting with his nose pressed against the front gate in a state of great anticipation. The horse's only thought was to go forward, to fly out of the gate of his own free will, and to canter down to the pace horse, who was always held back a touch to allow the novice to overtake him and win the race. The once nervous horse was having fun. I was deeply impressed by what I had witnessed, and I wanted to know all about it. "You know," said Farrell as he sucked on the wad of tobacco parked down the side of his back teeth, "I've watched a whole lot of these races, and I've watched them pretty carefully, as you do when there's maybe a sum of money riding into your pocket if you make the right choices. And I saw an interesting thing. It ain't the horses who are all jazzed up who are starting the quickest. Those ones are so busy banging about from side to side and running on the spot and thinking about what evildoer is behind them that they have less time to notice whether the gate's flying open. No, it's the animals who are most relaxed. They're the ones who are making the flying starts." Farrell proved to me that the cruelty of whipping horses in the stall to make them afraid and want to escape was not only unnecessary, it was counterproductive. It made the horses slower off the mark. I learned a great deal that day. My way of thinking about horses was enriched by this critical idea. A rider or trainer should never say to a horse, "You must." Instead, the horse should be invited to perform, because I would like you to. Taking that a step further, to ask a horse to perform is not as clever as causing him to want to perform. Horses naturally want to run. And if they're trained correctly, we can harness their willingness to do just that, to race to their potential. As it turned out, I'd worked for most of my life in the thoroughbred racing industry, and to this day I'm fervent in my belief that whips should be banned. There's no need for them if training procedures take advantage of a well-bred horse's overpowering desire to run. At Flag Is Up Farms, exercise riders sometimes carry a crop. We are, after all, training horses for the track, and a horse that has never seen a whip may throw the first jockey to use one. A rider at our farm then may tap a horse, but if that rider raises a welt, that rider is gone. Trevor Denman, the track announcer at the Santa Anita and Del Mar racetracks in California, has actually timed horses under the whip. He has determined that most horses slow down when they're whipped. The whip is simply a bad tool. We have no need for it. Farrell Jones would become the leading thoroughbred trainer in the United States several times over. His son Gary, one of the top trainers in North America. Farrell's methods and original thinking have stood me in good stead since I learned that first lesson from him. Frank Vessels, one of the major quarter horse owners in the United States, would launch the Quarter Racing Association in 1945. And soon he'd elevate sprint racing into the same class of event as thoroughbred racing. By 1946, the American Quarter Horse Association had formed, with a team of inspectors touring the United States adding to their register those horses with the right conformation. From hanging onto the neck of a quarter horse as it blasted down those rough tracks, we all started the quarter horse racing industry. And I learned something about horses and starting gates. When I was 9 years old, my Uncle Ray told me a story from our Cherokee ancestry, an old way that would have a place in my new way of thinking about horses. My grandfather, Earl Roberts, was born in Wales in 1870. My love of horses may have come from him, because he farmed with them and also used them for fox hunting and pleasure riding. But at 17, he was lured to the West by the promise of steady work, building roads over the Sierra Nevadas. In Spanish, Sierra Nevada means snow-covered mountains, an unassuming phrase for the massive natural barrier that forms the border between California and Nevada. In North America, only the Rocky Mountains are bigger. In the Sierras, crews could work only 6 months of the year. Passes were otherwise closed. In 1846, the ill-fated Donner Party wagon train tried to cross the Sierras in the fall and were swallowed by one of its fierce early winters. I can barely imagine the work involved in cutting through those mountains using only man and beast. Young Earl was hired to supply the horses that pulled the equipment on these road projects, as well as to provide saddle horses for the foreman directing the crews. The laborers were typically immigrants like my grandfather, but also among them were Indians of the Cherokee Nation, who were brought to Nevada from their reservations in the Midwest by the federal government. In that number was a woman who would become my grandmother, a young Cherokee girl in her late teens. I wish I knew her Indian name. They called her Sweeney, after the agent who had transported her family to Nevada. Among her few possessions were papers qualifying her as a full-blooded Cherokee entitled to specific native-born rights. Earl petitioned her family for her hand in marriage, and in quick succession she bore him 9 children, 5 of whom survived, including my father and my Uncle Ray. When Ray, her youngest child, was 11 years old, Sweeney decided that her marriage contract with Earl had been fulfilled. One day when the family got up in the morning, they found her gone. Months passed while they searched for her. In the end, they discovered that she had walked from Tulare back to the Cherokee Indian Reservation, a distance of 600 miles. When I knew her, she had gone salt and pepper gray. She was about 5 feet 6 inches tall, fairly tall for a Cherokee woman of the late 1800s. My father told disparaging stories about her and was not pleased that I sought her company. She was forbidden fruit. My grandmother spoke little English, words, not sentences, and she never said anything in front of my mother. But she seemed to come alive when we were alone together, and she would rattle on in Cherokee, holding me close. But in her life she was not content. Shortly after she walked away, Ray developed pneumonia. Earl decided to take the boy back to Sweeney on the reservation, where Ray was adopted into the Cherokee tribe and raised to adulthood. He thus had the benefit of learning the Indian way as well as the white man's way. Uncle Ray told me that when the Cherokee wanted to capture wild horses on the Great Plains, their problem was how to get close enough to rope them. They overcame this obstacle in a remarkable fashion. Instead of driving them into the neck of a valley or building other traps of that sort, difficult given the landscape, they used a much quicker method. First of all, they followed the herd of horses. They didn't drive them hard, but simply walked after them, pressing them away. This would continue for a day or two. Then, when the time was right, the Cherokee would turn and walk in the opposite direction. Invariably, in a kind of yo-yo effect, the horses would turn around and follow them. The Cherokee would then simply lead the wild herd into corrals between 2 and 5 acres in size. Apparently, the Cherokee used similar tactics to get close to the beasts they hunted, deer, antelope, and buffalo. To be effective with a bow and arrow, the hunter needed to be within 40 or 50 feet of his target. He'd press the animals away from him for a while, then turn around and head back the other way. The animals would turn and follow. After this pattern between hunter and prey had been repeated several times, the hunters found themselves near enough to make an easy kill. When my Uncle Ray told me the story of hunted animals circling back to check out the hunter, it was a mystery to me. Later on, when I had the opportunity to observe horses in the wild for myself, I would come to understand the reasons for their curious tendency to turn back and seek intimacy with their pursuers. I'd give the phenomenon a name, advance and retreat, and it would form the basis of my technique in working with horses. The years of the Second World War had been filled with death. In one way or another, whether actual or metaphorical, war brings darkness. I was 10 when the war finally ended in 1945, and in my small world, the death of my dream seemed as certain as it had when we first moved away from the competition grounds. I had seen my Japanese-American classmates rounded up and interned at a prison camp located at my former home. I'd witnessed the death of the black man at the hands of my father, which caused me to lose respect for him and to seek my own path in life. Ironically, while I was trying hard to dissociate my life from his, he was giving me what I wanted more than anything else, a life with horses. With the war over, it was a mad scramble to return to normalcy. For my father, this meant gearing up to return to our business at the competition grounds and entering me in as many equestrian competitions as he could find around the country, which was exactly what I wanted to do. But it was frantic. The grounds were in a horrible state. We dragged magnets around for weeks because the workmen who had dismantled the living quarters had left nails and roofing tacks on the ground, where they posed a threat to the horses' feet. We put the stables back in order, restored the feed stalls, repaired floors, and mended roofs. My mother's entire family turned up to volunteer their help. We sawed the back off the Cadillac to turn it into a pickup, and it went back and forth to the dump, carting away rubbish. I recall the day when the new saddles arrived, 20 or 30 of them, all dumped in the yard at the same time. I tore at the packages to get them out and ready for the start of lessons the following day. We were back in our old house, back in business. But with the cost of all this equipment, not to mention the horses themselves, came heavy overhead. We held grave family conferences around the kitchen table. It was decided that my father would remain in the police force because he had risen to the rank of lieutenant and his salary could help to fund our debts. If we were to succeed, my father told us, we'd have to do it on our own and without much hired help. We could afford only one man, the same Wendell Gio who had worked for us beforehand. Wendell was jockey-sized and claimed a jockey past, but no one could find a trace of it. He was full of stories whose detail shifted with his moods. Wendell also claimed he had boxed, and he certainly had the face of someone who had been on the receiving end of many punches. His ears were elephantine and cauliflower, his nose flat and pushed off to one side. People said he had the look of a monkey. He would use his knuckles to rise up from a table. His were the hands of a worker, and few worked as hard and fast as he did. Wendell wasn't vulgar, did not drink like so many ranch hands. He was a good man, not the brightest, but always with a joke or a laugh, and we couldn't have gotten along without him. To fit in the necessary work of helping Wendell, schooling for Larry and me was cut back to bare bones. Wendell would arrive at the stables at 4:30 a.m. and immediately start feeding the 60 horses we were now stabling. I rolled out of bed sometime before 5 o'clock and struggled into the same working clothes that had lain in a heap on the floor where I had dropped them the night before. I scooted, for I had 22 stalls to muck out before breakfast. Because he was younger and not as strong, Larry had 10 stalls to clean. I barely paused to call out a greeting to Wendell before cleaning and raking each stall, rolling back the bedding, adding straw, and on to the next one. As I went, I counted the seconds. The aim was to take no more than 3.5 minutes or 210 seconds for each stall. Ideally, all 22 stalls were done in just under an hour and a half. It was like a race. When I finally threw the pitchfork back against the wall, I would raise both hands in the air like rodeo calf ropers do to stop the clock. Breakfast was at 6:30. As Larry and I ate, our father issued instructions on which horses to ride and what exercises each required. After breakfast, Wendell cleaned out the remaining 30-odd stalls while Larry and I were out riding. From 7 to 9, I rode perhaps 6 horses with a variety of training programs and tasks to be accomplished. After that, we trotted back to the house and showered and changed, ready for the start of school at 9:30. At 1:30, we returned to the competition grounds and were straight back in the saddle, training 5 to 6 horses apiece. So by mid-afternoon, I had 4 hours of riding behind me. Then all of us, my father, mother, my brother, and I, gave riding lessons to classes ranging from 6 to 12 people. Some were scared stiff of horses, others were above it all, some were attentive. We pressed on, doing the best we could. At 5:30 p.m., my mother took the Cadillac and delivered the children back home. Larry, Wendell, and I would finish up by stabling and feeding the horses and cleaning the tack. By 6:30, my mother was preparing dinner, and I was her helper, which got me interested in cooking. Then after dinner, there was schoolwork. Even though I was only in school for between 10% and 40% of the normal time, my father insisted I keep up the best possible grades. By anyone's standards, he was a hard taskmaster. A child's capabilities are elastic at that age, and he stretched mine to the limit. But perhaps as much credit should go to the tutor hired for me, a Miss Marguerite Parsons. That I wanted to take the school tests at all is a credit to her kindness and understanding. Despite my prolonged absences from the classroom, I would achieve near straight-A grades at school. Like a cartoon character, I had the carrot in front of me, the whip behind. The end of the war created a surplus of cheap military hardware, and among local ranchers it became fashionable to zip around in nearly new military jeeps or armored cars. My father joined in this craze, but in his own remarkable way. He leased a railroad car once used by the U.S. Cavalry. Framed in metal, its wood painted dark green, the car bore military numbers on the outside and, barely discernible beneath the paint, the American Eagle. A minimal payment secured it for several years. Designed to take officers' horses around the country on the rail network, it came equipped with shipping stalls for 15 horses. My father reasoned that though competitions were few and far between, and even less publicized, the railroad car would get us there. He was also confident that the competitions would inevitably increase in number when normal life returned, and he wanted to be prepared to take full advantage. Builders removed 6 stalls in the car and constructed in their place a bunk room and a feed room with a bin for the grain and a large container for water. A minimal kitchen area offered a hot plate and a spot for making coffee. For the next few years, this railroad car would crisscross the United States. It was my home away from home during long spells in summer. My father and I would consult the advertised schedules for horse shows, select the best ones, and then take our itinerary to Southern Pacific. Railroad officials would give us a series of pickup times and siding numbers. We might be car 21 in siding number 56, for example. And at the appointed time, the railway did run on time in those days, a switch engine would pull us from the siding onto the main track. The train would back up to us, our car would be hitched up, and off we'd go. My father stayed behind to attend to his duties as a policeman, and as a trainer manager of the horses. Traveling in the car with me were my favorite horse, Brownie, anywhere up to 8 other horses, a groom, sometimes Wendell, and Miss Marguerite Parsons. She was a central figure in my life. I still own a striking portrait photograph of her. She has her hair up in the 1940s style. We called it the Rosie the Riveter look, after a cartoon character of the day. And what a luxuriant mane of hair it is. The chin is slightly pointed, the nose prominent. She has deep brown eyes, kindly eyes. You'd look at that photograph and say, here's a woman of character. In the bunk room of the railroad car, the tiny, wasted Miss Parsons slept on the other side of a curtain strung along a pole. When we had all retired for the night, I'd hear a strange whispering sound from her side of the curtain. It wasn't a human sound, and no horse ever made one like it. It had to be emanating from Miss Parsons. I didn't know what it was, and I never asked. It was only some years later that the whispering was made plain to me. It was the pleasing sound of a woman's underclothing, silk on silk or the rustle of nylons. But in my bunk I could make no sense of the whispers, which only added to the quality of mystery that enveloped Miss Marguerite Parsons. She had been our babysitter since I was 2 or 3 years old, and now she became my teacher as well. Neat, clean, and steady as a rock, she read me stories and made learning fun. Always in long skirts and dresses, she was strict and serious, but very caring and warm. Above all, she was instructive. If Miss Parsons had a fault, she kept it hidden from me, and I loved her as pupils always loved their favorite teacher. She was only in her mid-20s, but mature beyond her years, even wise. It seemed to me that she was always right in what she said and did, She wouldn't leave us until 1949 when I was 14 years old. She understood me better than my parents did and sympathized with my problems. She gave me lessons I value now. She taught me how to communicate with people. She encouraged me to relax. And she made me understand that if I was to pursue a career as a horseman with such single-minded dedication and from such a young age, I'd have to pace myself or burn out. I remember heading for a show in Pomona in Southern California. It was one of the first times we used the railroad car, and simply preparing for it put me in a state of high excitement. We cleaned and sorted the saddles and bridles and arranged them in boxes fitted to one wall of the railroad car. In this way, we could simply lift out the boxes and stack them in the van so the equipment wouldn't be damaged or soiled en route to the showground. "Ramp up! Ramp up!" exclaimed Miss Parsons as soon as the horses and equipment were loaded and we were all inside. There was some urgency in her voice. A ramp was a welcome mat for mice. She worried obsessively about rodents, which were plentiful at all the railroad sidings. Grain spilled during transport offered them a healthy food supply. Miss Parsons maintained a keen mouse vigil as well as a comprehensive extermination program inside the railroad car. And when not chasing mice, she continued a brave but futile crusade against dust as we rolled from one siding to another. A perfectionist, she posted lists of rules and regulations around the car, which we were asked to read every day. Many signs had mice in mind. Keep doors closed. Spill grain. Clean up every kernel. Horse droppings are to be cleaned immediately. Keep lids tightly in place on manure cans. Before heading off, Miss Parsons would sort out the homework she would take with us to let me keep pace with my schooling. She prepared my homework and wrote out tests for me at the little desk she set up in the car. She performed her task and I mine during long stopovers and at night when the train was stopped, lest both of us become too ill with motion sickness from trying to read and write while underway. The switch engine would pull us onto the main track, and a gentle bump and the clink of the hitch told us we were now one of many wagons hitched to the engine that we could hear steaming away at the head of the train. South Pacific took us down through San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, Ventura, and on toward the Los Angeles Basin. Peering out through the heavy wire mesh guarding the windows, we could look ahead as the train snaked around a mountain or into the dozen or so tunnels that went right through the mountains. Rolling along the then pristine, unpopulated coast, we could look out to the tranquil beauty of the ocean. This was train travel, but wind-in-your-hair train travel, which most people never experience. The slow rhythm of the wheels rolling over the track settled all of us, horses, Wendell, Miss Parsons, and me, into a routine as we made our way south. After the tunnels and the slow route beside the sea, Los Angeles was an eye-opener. So many cars and buildings and people squeezed together constituted an alien land. But finally we arrived at Pomona. This was an upscale, fiercely competitive show, and I faced it with trepidation. I could be reasonably confident of winning in some of the shows I went to, but Pomona was different, and in one way unique. The owner of the facility, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg of Kellogg Cereals, had built a spur line connecting his grounds to the main Southern Pacific network. No need to park in a siding and transport horses and equipment to the showground. We simply chugged down the spur line, dropped the ramp, and the main arena lay right before us. The other contestants, who had to stable their horses a mile away, looked on in amazement at this kid who just parked next to the arena in his own train. It was a good psychological tactic. I had already won pole position. But I'd need any advantage. This was a serious event, with a 2,000-seat stadium and a parade of superbly equipped competitors mounted on expensive horses. I'd have to give Brownie all the help I could muster to cut a path anywhere near the top. A current of excitement coursed through Brownie, too. He was as charged up as I was. Because of his breeding, part aristocrat, part Mustang, his nerves were always highly tuned. And he knew this was something special. As I let him out and then returned to help Wendell with the other horses, A line of children began to form a small audience. They continued to observe impassively as I, only 11 myself, warmed up Brownie, putting him through his paces as any athlete would, to warm up the ligaments and tendons and to push his blood around his body a bit faster after the long journey with inadequate exercise. As the children watched, I had the sense that Brownie and I were the other team, tagged as the opposition. During the warm-up, something caught my eye in a ring some distance away. A horse coming to a dead stop from a gallop, a cloud of dust under his belly, the hind feet tucked neatly underneath and taking the strain of the sliding halt. I was impressed, even elated at the sight, but depressed too. Surely, I thought to myself, there's the winner of my junior class. As I rode over, I saw, with no small measure of relief, that the rider was an adult. He'd compete in a different division. Drawing closer, I recognized Clyde Kennedy riding Rango, the Southern California champion reined cowhorse. I'd been impressed, even from afar, with good reason. Still somewhat daunted by the professional atmosphere, I felt uncertain and unsure of our prospects. When it was time for my class, Wendell brought Brownie across to me. Watching my horse stride over, the single white dot like a third eye as he carried himself along in his usual steady fashion, I suddenly knew I had the best horse. In the saddle, with my hand on his neck, I sensed his low pulse rate and his capable attitude, and adopted it myself to calm my nerves. I had doubted him, but no longer. We felt like professionals. Figure eights were Brownie's Achilles heel, but he hit the flying changes on this occasion unusually well. I knew Clyde Kennedy was watching me. I had found a new hero, and I wanted to impress him. When it came to do the stops, Brownie accomplished the first two reasonably quickly, but without any reaction from the crowd. The third stop I can remember to this day because I asked Brownie, "Whoa!" when we were galloping in the center of the ring, and he slid to a quivering, perfect halt in 30 feet. We stood in that cloud of dust while the crowd roared. It was the kind of applause that goes up at a football game after a touchdown, and I knew then, before the backing up and the offsets, that we had done fine. At the outgate, Clyde Kennedy was there to congratulate Brownie on his performance and ask me if I had a trainer. I told him no, but that I had seen him on Rango earlier and I would take any lessons I could from him. Clyde came over to the railroad car and looked around inside, intrigued by the arrangement. That night he joined Miss Parsons and me in the railroad workers' cafeteria a short way up the track. As we sat down to our meal, I learned about the rivalry between Clyde and Jimmy Williams, the local favorite in Pomona. Clyde continued to ask questions about the railroad car. Miss Parsons was proud to tell him how we were strictly tied to a low budget. There was no candy or soft drinks for young Monty Roberts. If he was lucky, he might get to open the box of scrap leather and mend some of his equipment. If he ever had a spare moment after collecting used Coca-Cola bottles so he could get the deposits back. Clyde shook his head in amusement. That night as I lay in the railroad car, I could hear children whispering and running around outside. They were looking for Brownie, who had become something of a hero. On the outside of the railroad car was pinned a line of rosettes, as well as spurs and belt buckles and other prizes. Brownie took this celebrity in stride, as though he thought it was his due. He wasn't an arrogant horse, simply one unfazed by almost any experience that didn't involve paper. On the last day of the show, the rivalry between Jimmy Williams and Clyde Kennedy was played out in the open division. Jimmy's horse, Red Hawk, could spin like a top. His sliding stops could be seen for miles around, the dusk-like Cherokee smoke signals. The crowd was rooting for him. Clyde Kennedy, though, was superb on Rango. With only Miss Parsons, Wendell, and me to cheer him on, Rango executed the figure eights with style, effortlessly flying from one lead to the other as if he were ambidextrous. His pirouettes were a blur, all the while holding his head and neck straight and never allowing his front feet to tangle while spinning in both directions. I had already seen his marvelous stops and wasn't surprised when he won, but it was thrilling to witness nonetheless. Wendell, Miss Parsons, and I loaded ourselves and our horses back into the railroad car, ready to be hauled back to the main line. Next stop, Tucson, Arizona, more than 8 hours away. My whole life, invariably a life with horses, seemed to stretch out before me, as straight and as uncomplicated as the railway track itself. Recently, I had occasion to revisit Pomona to give a lecture at a breeder's symposium. As I drove the car past a wild, grassy area and a broken-down fence line, I had a flashback. I said to Pat, "Hang on, I've been here before. Follow me and I'll show you." I cut a path through the tall grass and we went about 100 yards up the valley. "I bet you," I said, "there's a disused single-track railway line up here." Pat followed me but gave me a doubting look. A little way off, I found the old length of iron and some wasted railway ties. We walked down the track to the spot where the showground had been. The spectators' grandstand had been dismantled, but the main ring itself was still discernible as an oval shape, the railings grassed over and choked with weeds. Suddenly, that day, half a century ago, its clear sense of triumph and excitement came back to me. The reality of the place, the showground itself, was eroding. The event lived on only in the minds of those who had taken part. In a few years, all trace of it would be gone. It was a powerfully nostalgic feeling to stand where I had stood as a boy. It stirred my soul and took me totally by